Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with no news people today, but the lovely Lamia doing the teching for us today. I'll give you a rundown of what we're going to talk about on the show today. There's a lot on the program. First, we're going to kick it off with a recipe from a good friend of mine named Brandy, and she's going to tell us about her fantastically, bizarrely good, very simple recipe for unvegan butter tarts that a friend of mine said were actually better than he remembered butter tarts ever being, and they only have four ingredients. So we're going to talk with her right away, and she's going to give us the recipe. We're going to do that instead of news today. and then we're going to talk with the visionary behind the Meat Tricks. He is the co-founder of Free Range Graphics, and he put together the Meat Tricks and a bunch of other really cool flash animations. But this one, the Meat Tricks, was about factory farming, and it was insanely popular. I think something like 3 million people have clicked on the Meat Tricks, which is themeattricks.com. If you're near a computer and you haven't had a chance to see it, but you probably have because so many people talked about it. And his name is Jonas Sachs, and he'll give us the lowdown on alternative and activist-oriented graphic designing, as well as give us the inside scoop on the making of the Meat Tricks. And then in the last half hour, we're going to hear from Paul Shapiro, who is a Compassion Over Killing investigator. And last week, we heard from Ian Park, who is the president of Compassion Over Killing. We just got a taste of what Compassion Over Killing has been up to lately. But we're going to be hearing about their adventures in terms of doing media outreach and doing their chicken industry investigation. They just launched a new documentary called 45 Days, The Life and Death of a Broiler Chicken. And they have also just put out a new website that is on the chicken industry, which is called www.chickenindustry.com, if you want to check it out. And we're going to talk with Paul about all the undercover work that they've done, all the media outreach that they've done, and what they found out about the chicken industry. So before we do that, though, we're going to hear from Brandy, and she's going to tell us about her fantastic butter tart, which is a non-butter tart, vegan butter tart, and it has only four ingredients. And when I tried these a couple days ago before we went to go see the corporation, this was our pre-corporation snack, I was quite ecstatic, and I begged Brandy to make them again for me, which she did. So, Brandy, could you tell us about these butter... Do they even call them butter tarts anymore?
Yeah, well, they do, except there's hardly any butter... There's not actually any butter in them at all, except for in the crust, which is really strange, because I was looking at a recipe last night, and, like, classic old farmhouse-style butter tarts have no butter in them.
Huh.
They're heavy on the eggs, and they're heavy on the other crappy ingredients, but
right.
That's it. There's okay. Actually no butter in... Yeah, there's no butter in them.
Okay. So this is a pretty easy recipe for people who maybe are new to baking or vegan baking. So if you have a pen, I would encourage you to at least try these. Trust me, they're really fantastic. So tell us how you make them.
Okay. First of all, there's actually six ingredients.
Okay.
A little bit of vanilla and a little bit of oil that I forgot about.
Okay.
Okay, so there's six ingredients.
A mere six ingredients.
A mere six ingredients and a mere four steps.
Okay.
So, four steps. Well, I guess, actually, there could be five steps, depending on what kind of pie crust you're going to use.
No!
Yeah, okay. So, if you're doing it in five steps, the first step would involve making a pie crust. And you can make whatever pie crust you want. When I make pie crust at home, I use spelt flour, but you can use wheat flour if you want a little bit of an easier pie crust to roll out. So you just make the pie crust with whatever recipe you like to use, roll it out, cut it into small circles, and press it into muffin tins. And so then that's step one, and you don't have to pre-bake it. But if you want to skip that step, you can go down to Dominion Superstore and purchase white flour, vegan, pre-made tart shells in little aluminum extremely wasteful cups for $2.50 for 12. And that would eliminate the first step in probably a half an hour of time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then the four following easy steps are, number one is to warm up the syrups in a pot for 5 minutes until they get thin and they start to foam. Lauren, should I give the actual ingredients first? Would that make more sense?
Sure, yeah, give the ingredients
okay.
first and then I'll do the...
So the ingredients are 4 cups of chopped nuts, 1 cup of brown rice syrup, 1/2 cup of maple syrup, 1/2 cup of soy or rice milk, 1/4 cup of safflower oil, or I guess whatever kind of oil you have in your house, not all of those, and 1 tablespoon of vanilla. Okay, so then step one is to warm up the syrup, the brown rice syrup and the maple syrup, in a pot on low for 5 minutes, and they'll get really thin, because when you're putting them into the pot, they'll be really goopy and kind of like working with thick caramel. But once they get a little bit warm, they'll get very, very thin, not quite like water, and they'll get a really peculiar white foam on the top. Yeah, it's very odd. And then you dump that into a bowl, and then you stir in the chopped nuts, the soy milk, the oil, and the vanilla, and they just they come together really easily, so you only stir it for a couple of minutes, and then you scoop it into the shells, and then you bake it, and that's it.
How long do you bake it for?
375 for 20 to 45 minutes. There's a really big range there, because it depends on the shells that you're using. If you're using your own shells, it will probably be a little bit longer, and if you're using pre-made ones, the ones from Dominion Superstore, it will depend on how long they've been sitting out. If they've only been sitting out for 5 minutes, they'll take a little bit longer, but if they've been sitting out for 20 minutes, then they'll be quicker. But it's important not to fill the shells up over three quarters full, otherwise they'll bubble up and overflow onto your oven bottom, and then it will start to smell.
How do you know when they're done?
When the tarts get a little bit brown on the edge.
Okay. And where did you get this recipe from?
It is kind of from this macrobiotic cookbook that I have called Cook the Way You Want to Live Your Life. It's a very funny cookbook, but I've kind of changed it a little bit because her ingredients, I've added a little bit more maple syrup and a little bit more vanilla and adjusted the quantities of nuts because she didn't use enough, I didn't think. But the fun thing about this recipe is that you can take away some of the nuts if you want and add raisins or currants if you want more of a traditional style butter tart, because I guess they usually have raisins. Is that right?
I think so.
And you can increase the amount of liquid if you want a gooier one, because this is gooey, but I think a little bit heavy on the nuts.
Yeah, it's all about the nuts.
It's all about the nuts.
They're really, really good. They're divine. When did you first make them?
I went to somebody's house for a vegetarian soap making class once about 3.5 years ago, and she had this little plate of desserts, and of course I was like, ooh, desserts. And then I went straight for the desserts, and I bit into one just as my friend Eric had bit into one, and we looked at each other, and we like had to lean on each other for support. We were like, oh my god.
Hey, you looked at me like I was kind of crazy when I was so ecstatic about
it. I know. But yeah, I see. I didn't express that to her. I was just like, this is really great. Where is this recipe from? And she had made it actually from the book. And then I think it's better the way that I make it, but whatever. It's a little bit sweeter, I think, because there's maple syrup and not all brown rice syrup.
How about you give us the recipe list again, or the ingredient list, just to get, in case people didn't get a chance to write it down, just quickly.
Sure. It's 4 cups of nuts, and I use a mix of nuts. I use pecans and walnuts and almonds, and I usually buy them whole, and then I chop them up myself. But you can buy them chopped. I think they're cheaper that way. 1 cup of brown rice syrup, which is you can buy at Noah's, sometimes at the big grocery stores as well, in the natural section. 1/2 cup of maple syrup, and I think you have to use the real stuff, I would imagine, because of the sugars, but maybe you can use Aunt Jemima, I'm not sure. It wouldn't be very healthy that way. 1/4 cup of soy or rice milk or almond milk or oat milk or whatever kind of non-dairy milk you want to use, and 1/4 cup of oil. I use safflower, but you can use whatever except for olives, and 1 tablespoon of vanilla.
Great.
That's it.
They're really good. Thanks, Brandy.
No problem.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. We are going to go for a short musical break, then we're going to get Jonah Sachs on the line, and he is the co-founder of Free Range Graphics, which just isn't about animal issues. They do work for Amnesty International as well as a bunch of other really cool groups, and he's going to talk about his visionary process in creating The Meatrix, which is themeatrix.com. There's also a new Noveel animation that they put out as well, which is pretty interesting. So we're going to talk about doing activist-orientated graphic design, and then we're going to come back after that and talk with Paul Shapiro from Compassion Over Killing. So Jonah Sachs should be on the line.
I'm here.
Hi, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So Free Range Graphics, the website anyway, describes Free Range Graphics as top quality design and publicity services to companies and organizations whose vision goes beyond turning the world into a strip mall, which I thought was a pretty great way of describing what you guys do.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about why you co-founded Free Range Graphics and what you're all about?
Sure. I had a career as a journalist before beginning a career as a designer, and was really interested in kind of communicating on a mass scale to lots of people the ideas that that me and a lot of the people who who share my values had. And I thought the best way to do it was through words. But as I went through my journalistic work, I realized as well that the use of imagery and how words are presented is equally important as to what the words are saying themselves. So I started branching out into design and imagery. And I wanted to get into advertising and mass communications, but was really kind of scared off and shy of working on corporate type of media, things where I felt if I was speaking untruth to millions of people at a time, I could never really live with myself. Mm-hmm. So I decided to start a graphic design company that would focus on nonprofits and political causes that were close to my heart, and have felt really rewarded by doing so.
Mm-hmm. And were you confident that you'd be able to make a living doing this?
Started off pretty small with my ambitions to make a living. I wanted to just be able to buy another computer and pay the rent on
right.
my house and get by that way. And so me and my business partner, Lewis, who founded the company with me, lived on my sofa for a few months while we worked together on one computer. And we're just sort of hoping that we could just make enough to scrape by.
Right.
So we didn't ever really envision having a big company, but we've grown quite a lot beyond our expectations.
Right. So, yeah, so tell us about some of the projects that you've worked on, some of the clients that you've had.
Well, we've worked with a lot of the major American nonprofits and international nonprofits, folks like Amnesty International, Sierra Club, World Wildlife Federation. We just did some work for the Planned Parenthood March for Women's Lives down here, the big million or so person march on Washington for women's right to choose.
Mm-hmm.
We've also recently, now that it is an election year, we've branched out more into politics, and we worked on the Dean campaign until that came to its end, and
mm-hmm.
now we're working on the Kerry campaign as well.
Okay.
So we do some more mainstream political stuff, and then a lot of more activist kind of campaign stuff.
And what kind of criteria do you use in terms of evaluating? Do you have a lot of clients coming to you, and you go through a process of sort of selecting who you're going to work with and who you're not, or...?
Well, we actually, one of the lucky things that happened for us is that we picked a kind of persona and a name and a logo for our company, the Running Chicken,
right.
that sort of self-selects in some ways.
Okay.
We don't have to spend a lot of time turning away clients or being tempted by big money clients that we actually don't want to work for, because it really is self-selecting. A lot of people look at our website and say, this is the kind of people I want to work with, or they're just not. And so because we're so heavily in our niche, we usually attract the kind of people that we want to work with. From time to time, we look at a project and say, this is not really us, or more likely than saying that, you know, we just don't agree with the morals of this project, so we won't do it, because we don't get too many requests like that. We do sometimes look at projects and say, we're not sure this would be effective, that this would actually serve our clients' goals, and so we'll turn down projects that we don't think will actually make a splash.
Mm-hmm.
So that happens from time to time. And then working for nonprofits and causes, it's really important that the money that they spend is actually being used, because that's money that people have donated to them and people have entrusted to them. So we try to have more of a bottom line than just taking money in. We try to make that money really work for our clients.
Yeah, let's talk about that. Like how one of the things that we talk about on this program all the time, we talk to lots of different activists and people doing a whole range of different types of, or employing a whole range of different types of strategies. And one of the things we go back to over and over again is evaluating what is effective and what is successful. And so what kind of criteria do you guys use in terms of trying to decide if something's been effective or not?
Well, we do work in all kinds of media, but our flash movies are sort of what we're most well known for, and I can talk most specifically about our flash activism movies because they're easiest to track the results of. So the first thing that we do is we try to see basically raw how many people have seen our message. Now, a lot of the messages that we put out there, like the message of the Matrix, is a message that's not really necessarily getting a lot of play. So every person who sees it is a person who otherwise probably would not have thought about that particular subject that day.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like we're inundating them with another shoe ad or something. So we think just getting raw numbers is important. With the Matrix, we reached about 4.5 million unique visitors, which is a pretty wide range of people, a pretty large group of people to be thinking about factory farming issues.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. Then all of our movies have some sort of goal at the end, some sort of click-through that the user could take some sort of action. With the Matrix, it was about finding, we had two actions at the end. Some were about learning how to become vegetarian and how to live a good vegetarian lifestyle, and for for other endings, there was trying to find sustainable grown foods in your area. Mm-hmm. So we try to track how many people actually click through and take some of those actions, whether it's signing a petition, donating money, or changing their lifestyle, as the Meatrix asks people to do. Mm-hmm. And usually we'll take about 6 or 7% of the people who see the movie will actually do something about it. And that's pretty good compared to, for instance, direct mail rates, where when you get a piece of direct mail, your chances are more like 0.1% of returning the piece.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we measure sort of click-through success.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also the measurement of success by earned media. So the Meatrix is an issue, factory farming is an issue that's not really talked about very much in the mainstream media here in the U.S., but the Meatrix got it on CNN, and on CNN they played the Meatrix, and then they talked about factory farming issues. So we consider that a huge success
mm-hmm.
when it brings up issues in the mainstream press that it would not otherwise have been talked about. We got lots and lots of outside press, and it came off the Internet and went out into the more physical world, and we always consider that a success. And finally, we like to reach out beyond communities who might be interested in the issue to begin with. When we make a movie, it usually gets sent out to the list that the nonprofit or campaign owns, so maybe 30 or 40,000 email addresses of hardcore supporters. But it's not really them that we're trying to educate. We're trying to educate people beyond their social networks. So when we start hearing back from people who we thought we would never be able to reach, for instance, the Arkansas football team had a big spot on their discussion board about the Meatrix, the fans of the Arkansas football team. It was the number one site on Blogdex, which tracks what's being talked about on blogs. Then we know that it's going out and educating people beyond the hardcore activists.
Yeah.
And finally, what we'd like to do for the actual people who are activists is we'd like to give them a new framework for thinking about an issue. So people always say, oh, well, maybe you're just preaching to the choir. But what we say we're doing is we're trying to arm the choir with some good new information and good new ways of talking about to their friends and talking about to their families. If they can get a metaphor that sums up the way that they feel, then they can borrow our imagery to make the argument to the people that they know, and it kind of spreads by word of mouth that way.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to do exactly what people do for major commercial products. Basically, we're trying to do that for smaller activist ideas.
Right. It's incredibly impressive. I'm doing a school program right now where I'm focusing on industrial animal agriculture, and you know, I've been slugging away at this for a number of years now and doing various different things, and I think I must have had like 40 friends or something send me the Meatrix.
Wow.
Have you seen this yet? Of course I had, you know. But it was incredibly popular. I remember, you know, opening up the Globe and Mail and there was a whole article on the Meatrix. Can we talk about that, the vision behind that particular animation? Because it combined a whole bunch of things that I just didn't think necessarily were possible, which I guess kind of goes back to these ideas about what you said was, you know, in terms of evaluating what is effective, because you were able to combine sort of humor with this really serious topic. I was thinking, you know, how did these guys make factory farming kind of funny, but also got the point across and I didn't feel degraded the issue. So how did you go about envisioning what you were going to do for the Meatrix?
It's a good question, and there's actually a lot of questions in there that I'd like to address. To start with, as far as adding humor to a serious issue, before I get into actually how we came up with the Meatrix, we think it's really important to give humor to our ads so that they will be passed around. We don't want people to just sort of being laying a guilt trip or laying something unwelcomed into someone's email box, because that's not how it gets passed around. It has to have a level of entertainment. We'd like to think of our movies as a gift that you may pass from friend to friend.
Mm-hmm.
So we always want to work that in. Now, with something like factory farming, it's very difficult. We don't want to demean the issue. We don't want to take away from the seriousness of it. And there's also issues about sort of anthropomorphizing animals that, you know, is this really right? Is this the right way to go? Or does it kind of degrade the issue again? But what left a little opening for us with the Meatrix was that the way that we look at factory farming is already, as a culture, is already a cartoon of itself. We think of our food coming from happy family farms, and it's just simply not true. That's a caricature, and a sort of totally inaccurate caricature of where our food really comes from. So we felt that we weren't sort of taking it to the wrong place by making fun of that whole thing, making fun of that idyllic fat family farm, which really doesn't exist anymore for the most part. Of course, making the movie, we heard from a lot of the farmers who do have those kind of farms, But for the most part, when we get our food, it's coming from a place that's so unfathomably horrible that we can't even think of it. We have to create a fantasy world. Mm-hmm. And so we felt very comfortable stepping into that fantasy world and turning it on its head. The idea for the Meetrix came from we did a grant to reach out to about 300 nonprofits that we thought might be interested in working in our medium. And we did a grant program where we were going to give a free movie away. And we got about 50 applications for different ideas. And one thing that we noticed was that factory farming brought together, so we could only give one movie away, but factory farming brought together so many different issues. There was human rights, there was animal rights, there were workers' rights, there was the environment, there was nutrition issues, safety issues. It was sort of everything that people were applying for, where we could pull together in under one roof and do something about factory farming, and that really excited us. But we also saw it as a huge challenge because we're well aware of the dangers people have run into trying to publicize animal rights issues, mm-hmm. Really especially around food, and how there's a lot of effective and some ineffective use of showing shocking photos. You know, PETA is one of our clients, and we understand that approach as well. But we wanted to do something different with the flash medium that would take it to a new level, a different direction, and hit some people who may be just too turned off by the ugly images. Mm-hmm. But we were very challenged by it, and we felt that we took about 2 months of working on concepting, and definitely at times felt that we were doing a disservice to the grant by doing something on factory farming, because we felt like this will never get traction. No one's talking about it. No one's making the connection. Mm-hmm. It was also a challenge for us because it was the first time that we did something without a client. Really, part of the deal was that the client couldn't look over our shoulder and tell us what to do. So we were a little nervous that for the first time that we tried something that it would be a flop because we didn't have the client kind of guiding us at all. Mm-hmm. But at some point during the summer when we were working on it, we kind of seized onto that one little nugget that I explained before, which was this is so horrible that we can't even show ourselves what's really happening. And that should be a good indication that we should be doing something different. And suddenly we made the connection between, oh, that's kind of like the Matrix. You know, if only we knew, we wouldn't be able to go on living, so we create a fantasy world. And then pieces started falling into place really quickly. There was the scene in the Matrix where they're all in those feeding pods, and that was just like a factory farm. So we said, oh, there's a great bridge. And then, we thought of a funny name for Morpheus, which was Mufius, and, okay, there's another bridge. And when things start falling, when you're trying to bridge two ideas, and there's lots of little bridges that connect them, you know your idea is falling into place and it's going to work. So we kind of went with that momentum, and the final bridge we built was actually the name, kind of funnily enough. You might think that we had thought of the name before even thinking about, you know, what to do with it. But, we worked for a while, and we got to the end of the project. We had written it out, and for some reason we just could not name it, and I don't know why. But then I was, you know, just at a concert one day racking my brain, you know, and I was kind of spacing out and racking my brains for a name for this thing. Right. And when the Meetrix came into my head, I think we realized that, you know, it was sort of just meant to be. When you can create when all those pieces fit together, right, it's really meant to be. So we were really happy that we pulled it all together, but weren't sure. When we first made it, we really weren't sure where it was going to go, and we're just blown away and so excited to see how far it reached out to people, mm-hmm. and made a difference.
It definitely has the pop culture resonance in it. I mean, I wonder, 10 years from now, if people see it, what it will mean, if it'll have the same kind of resonance. So it's very timely.
Yeah, we released it the same day that Matrix 3 came out, which I didn't see, unfortunately.
Okay.
But I think I was so burnt out on the whole thing at that point. But it's a huge question. I think the culture is being invented and reinvented so quickly now that it's very hard to make anything that will be timeless. It's mm-hmm. very hard to make anything that will be relevant, especially because there's such a rush to jump in and kind of piggyback on things that are working at this very moment. So, we've found, somewhat to our dismay, that things only really get huge when they are spoofs of the hottest thing of the moment. And so we did a spoof on Queer Eye for the Straight Guy for the March for Women's Lives, and you know, it was an immediate giant hit. Not necessarily because of the content or the animation, but just because of the association of something that's hot at the moment. And so, you know, I do wonder what it'll be like to look back 10 years from now, although I'm sure the issue of factory farming and understanding factory farming will be equally relevant. I'm not sure if the matrix will survive.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing about free-range graphics is it sounds like, you know, you're all constantly reinventing what that company is about or what you all do. So it's, I'm sure you'll be able to keep the issue fresh for people.
I hope so.
So we only have a few minutes left, but I was curious if you could give us a sense of where free-range is going right now, and if you have any upcoming projects and just the new direction for free-range.
Sure. Right now, we're doing everything that we can to influence the upcoming election. We made a goal for ourselves back in September that we were going to be as big a player as we could in defeating George Bush. And a lot of, just because every issue that we work on is somehow related to his failed presidency, and we really wanted to get in there and make a change. So we were fortunate enough to be able to work with the Dean campaign and really be part of that cultural explosion. And then, you know, as a result, got picked up by the Kerry campaign. So we're focusing pretty heavily on that, but we're also realizing that once this election's over, whether we win or lose, there's still going to be the same issues that we need to keep fighting. So we did just release a movie about veal that takes place in an Italian restaurant that's pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
It can be seen at noveal.org. And so we're still working on a lot of those sort of food and animal issues. And we are also working on quite a number of environmental issues with the Endangered Species Act and some of the stuff that's going on here with endangered species and the legislation that surrounds it. So we're keeping our eyes out for the next big thing, but right now the big thing is the election.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for being on, Jonah.
Well, thanks for having me.
And how many people are actually working for Free Range at this point?
There are 12 people now.
12 people. Well, yeah. I always feel like when I'm doing these interviews that I should try to maintain my objective, voice as the interviewer. But obviously I'm so impressed and really excited about what Free Range is all about, and I look forward to seeing what you guys produce in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
really
so much.
I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Jonah Sachs. He's the co-founder of Free Range Graphics. You can check out, they have links to their various different projects through their website, which is www.freerangegraphics.com. And the Metrix is themetrix.com. And you can go there to the Free Range Graphics site and also see the No Veal campaign, the animation that they just did for that, which is sort of a spoof on mobster movies. So that was Jonah, and we're going to come back and talk with Paul Shapiro about the Compassion Over Killing recent investigation and documentary that they recently put out. Now we're going to switch gears and speak with Paul Shapiro, who has been involved with Compassion Over Killing for quite a while. He's an investigator and activist. They've been doing a lot of work at Compassion Over Killing, which is a Washington-based animal advocacy group that is working to end animal abuse. And Compassion Over Killing, according to their website, primarily focuses on cruelty to animals and agriculture and promotes vegetarian eating as a way to be kinder, to build a kinder world for all of us, both human and non-human. And it's always a real pleasure to talk with Compassion Over Killing. They're a very inspiring group. So, Paul, thanks for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lauren.
So tell us about Compassion Over Killing has been working on recently.
Oh, our most recent work has focused on the suffering and abuse endured by chickens who are raised for meat. The industry calls them broilers, because that's typically the way that they're cooked. However, what most people, even animal advocates, don't realize is that these birds represent approximately 80% of all of the animals who we kill, at least in the United States, and it's similar for other countries, including Canada, every single year. So that's to say, for example, in the United States, we kill about 10 billion animals in slaughter plants. 8 of those 10 billion happen to be chickens who are raised for meat. There are virtually no laws that protect these birds, and the abuse that they endure is not only rampant, but it's actually pretty extreme. So we've been working to expose that cruelty, to encourage people to explore chicken-free eating, and to write to their legislators and encourage them to abandon federal subsidies for factory farms and, more importantly, for their feed suppliers. You can see more about this investigation that we've conducted into the chicken industry with photos and videos and even a report surveying much of the scientific data on broiler chicken welfare at our new website, which is at chickenindustry.com.
Okay, so maybe for people who are new to the ideas of factory farming or thinking about factory farming, can you just give us a brief sketch of what the broiler conditions are like, or maybe even the hen conditions are like for battery cages with egg production?
Sure, that's a great question. Many people have this idyllic image in their mind when they think of animals who are raised for food, if they think of them at all. They think of these scenes where chickens are strutting around in barnyards, pigs are cooling themselves in mud baths, calves are suckling from their mothers, when in fact, very little could be further from the truth. The reality for these animals, at least most of them, is intensive confinement. So you ask about egg-laying hens. These birds, for example, are living in barren wire cages that are so tight they can't even flap their wings. In order to reduce the impact of stress-induced aggression, they have parts of their beaks burned off when they're chicks without painkillers, so that when they do attack each other in these intensive confinement situations, the damage is less severe. Probably egg-laying hens endure the worst abuse of any farm animal on a factory farm today. And it's funny because a lot of people, when they think of vegetarians or vegans, they think, oh, well, they're probably most offended by beef or steak or hamburgers, when in reality, that's not really the case. The case is that egg-laying hens endure the worst abuse, the most suffering per animal, than any other farmed animal in the world. However, the chickens who are raised for meat outnumber egg-laying hens exponentially. That's to say that we raise and kill far more broiler chickens than we do egg-laying hens. Mm. And the welfare concerns for them are not necessarily the same as they are for laying hens. Broiler chickens, those who are raised for meat, are not kept in cages. In contrast to egg-laying hens, they are kept on the floor of a large, usually about a football field long, warehouse. They live in their own manure in filthy conditions, and they are bred to grow so rapidly that oftentimes their hearts, their lungs, and their legs can't keep up with their unnaturally rapid growth rate, causing them to have all types of problems, from heart attacks, respiratory problems, abnormal gaits while walking. And so whereas the intensive confinement of the battery cage system isn't a problem for broiler chickens because they're not kept in those cages, their genetic breeding, which has forced them to basically suffer their entire lives, is probably the number one welfare concern. And of course, there are others, from the ammonia-polluted air that we force them to breathe on these factory farms, to the violent transport, catching, and slaughter practices that they endure. There are certainly a number of problems that they endure, but the genetic manipulation for fast growth is probably the number one welfare concern for broiler chickens.
And they live for 45 days, so that's the reason why the documentary was called that?
That's correct. In the 1950s, it took approximately 84 days to raise a 5-pound chicken, which is considered market weight. Today, scientists have been able to reduce that time to an industry average of about 45 days, and it can go even lower. That's only an industry average, but it just goes to show how much we've forced these birds to endure really extreme suffering at the in the pursuit of a more productive, more profitable bird. And it's not just animal advocates who claim these things. Even industry journals, for example, Feedstuffs, which is the weekly agribusiness news journal, had a report in which they said, and I quote, "Broilers now grow so rapidly that the heart and lungs are not developed well enough to support the remainder of the body, resulting in congestive heart failure and tremendous death losses." So when we make these allegations against factory farmers for abusing the animals, it's not as if these are just animal advocates who are alleging that there's animal cruelty going on. Even industry journals like Feedstuffs, which take a very pro-industry and anti-activism stance, are making the argument that, yes, there are serious welfare problems that need to be addressed. And so the title of our documentary, which you can watch clips from at chickenindustry.com, is 45 Days, The Life and Death of a Broiler Chicken.
I always feel like I should be wearing a shirt that says militant animal rights extremist. You know, if you talk about these issues, they so often get framed as if you're saying something that's just totally totally, you know, in a different league and doesn't make sense to people. And when you actually take a minute to look at the conditions, it really doesn't seem that wild to want to say, well, you know, there might be something wrong with what's going on here. I'm gonna ask you a question that a lot of people ask me, and I'm curious what you have to say about it. In terms of domestication, because we've been doing this to animals for so long, in terms of, you know, intervening in their reproductive cycles, etc., a lot of people say, well, you know, those conditions sound pretty bad, but, you know, those chickens are, they're genetically bred, and they don't suffer the same way that, you know, a wild chicken would, or they certainly don't suffer the way that a human would. And so they're kind of used to it, and they're born there, and that's what they're meant for. And because we've been doing this to them for so long, they don't really have the capabilities to experience, like, pain and suffering anymore.
Well, I mean, aside from stating the obvious fact that that's simply incorrect, there's an overwhelming amount of evidence that suggests that not only do these birds suffer, but they actually suffer pretty severely. Yes, we have domesticated these animals. We've altered the rates at which they grow, the rates at which they give milk or lay eggs, but we haven't removed their nerve endings. We haven't removed their capacity for frustration. And we, in all honesty, we haven't had them manipulated like this for that long. We're talking about possibly only half of a century in some cases that these animals have been seriously manipulated for productivity purposes, and that's clearly not enough time to lessen or eliminate their ability to feel pain. But if you visit chickenindustry.com, we have a whole page on from animal welfare scientists. These are people who are not necessarily vegetarian or animal advocates, but rather people who study the science of animal welfare. And they have all types of great quotes on here regarding not only chickens' abilities to feel pain and suffering, but also the fact that we've traditionally underestimated their mental lives. Many people think, oh, well, they're just bird brains. Well, that may be the case, but we need to redefine what we mean by bird brain, because these animals are actually a lot more intelligent, a lot more mentally complex than we'd ever imagined. And the argument that these birds are either stupid or don't feel pain are simply irrational and are constructed for the sole reason of trying to make ourselves feel better about exploiting them, when instead of trying to rationalize our abuse of those who can't defend themselves, we ought to be seeing how we can reduce their suffering and how we can each remove our support for cruelty to them. And I just want to read one quote from Dr. Bernard Rollin, who's a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. And he writes in his book, Animal Welfare, Farm Animal Welfare, he says, "The contrary to what one may hear from the industry, chickens are not mindless, simple automata, but are complex behaviorally, do quite well in learning, show a rich social organization, and have a diverse repertoire of calls. Anyone who has kept barnyard chickens also recognizes their significant differences in personality." So we need to realize that we've underestimated these birds in all types of capacities and start not only respecting them, but treating them as if they were living, feeling beings who care about their lives.
I think a lot of people, too, with chickens, and it seems a lot of smaller animals, and I feel this way with fish, too, that people say, well, they're just chickens. Like, you know, there's other bigger issues going on, and, you know, why are you guys putting so much effort into, you know, these chickens? Yeah, it's sad that we do this to them, and they should be treated better, but why aren't you putting your efforts somewhere else?
Well, I would reply to someone who asked that question by telling them that even if they don't think that this is the most serious moral problem in the world today, that at a bare minimum, they shouldn't be the cause of this cruelty. Even if they don't want to devote their lives to advocating the interests of animals, they should at a bare minimum not be the cause of animal suffering, or at least reduce their support for animal abuse. And I personally do think that the immense amount of violence and cruelty that we inflict on other animals is of tremendous moral import. We as a species are acting ruthlessly, we're acting greedily, and we are going to live to regret it. I have no doubt that future generations will look back in absolute horror when they read about and see the videos and photos of our current mistreatment of other animals simply because they weren't like us. And so I do think this is extremely morally important. But even for those who disagree, I wouldn't say that that I would spend much time trying to persuade them that this is the most important issue of today, as much as I would just try to persuade them that even if they want to work on issues that they consider more important, at a bare minimum, they shouldn't support these cruelties by buying animal products.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, what is compassion over killing then advocating? Is it not buying the products, or, you know, some people talk about free range, and there's a lot of debate about what that actually even means and if that's any better. What does compassion over killing think is the direction we should be moving in?
Well, I think that as individuals, the absolute best thing that we can do to help other animals is to stop eating them. That's to say that eating a vegan diet is hands down the most important thing that each one of us can do to help reduce animal suffering. It's not the only thing that we can do, but I do think it's the most important thing that we can do. But in general, I support any action that helps to reduce animal suffering. So if somebody reduces their animal consumption, I think that's a great step in the right direction. If somebody even, let's say, eliminates eggs because eggs cause the most abuse out of all the animal products, I think that's a good step in the right direction. If a company seeks to reduce the amount of suffering that they're causing to animals by implementing significant welfare improvements, I think that's a good step in the right direction. So it really depends on what position that we're in, whether, you know, we'd be the CEO of a company or a politician or just an individual. There are all different types of ways that we can reduce animal suffering. But presuming that most people listening to us right now are simply individuals who aren't heads of companies or politicians, I'd say the most important thing each one of us can do is to reduce and eliminate our animal consumption.
Compassion Over Killing has been working on these issues now for quite a while. I'm not sure when you were founded. When were you founded? In the 90s, or was it before then?
Compassion Over Killing was founded in 1995.
How do you, how do you keep these campaigns fresh? I know that you've worked on chicken issues before. This was a bit different. This was another investigation. How do you go about constructing your campaigns, and what launched this campaign in particular?
Well, I think what launched this broiler campaign is really that very little attention has been put on broiler chickens in the animal advocacy movement. That's not to say that no one has been focusing on them, because indeed groups like United Poultry Concerns and People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals have been trying to improve broiler conditions for some time now. But I think as a whole, most people and most organizations in the animal advocacy movement have not spent significant resources on this issue, despite the fact that these birds are the overwhelming majority of the animals who we exploit. Again, approximately 80% of all the animals who we kill in the United States every single year are broiler chickens. It's an absolute travesty that we don't have any laws protecting them whatsoever, and that most of the animal movement, I would venture to say, is relatively ignorant about the conditions that they're in. I know even just a few months ago before I had started researching the broiler industry and visiting farms and slaughter plants, I knew very little about what the most common welfare problems were for broiler chickens. And because of the huge numbers of animals involved here, in this case 8 billion in the United States, I think it's of the utmost importance that we not only study this issue, but really become well-versed and experts in it. And as far as your other question about how we keep our campaigns fresh, for better or for worse, there's just so much animal exploitation out there that I don't think it's hard to continue to find new angles at which we can help promote compassion toward other animals. And just one example is our campaign right now against the so-called Animal Care Certified seal that many egg producers are placing on their egg cartons. Rather than significantly improving welfare conditions on egg farms, what many egg producers now are doing is signing up with a voluntary program by which they can label their eggs so-called Animal Care Certified. We've taken this issue to governmental regulatory bodies, and as well to the Better Business Bureau's National Advertising Division, who ended up ruling that the Animal Care Certified logo is indeed misleading and should be discontinued because it implies, there's a reasonable interpretation that it implies the birds are afforded a higher level of care than is actually the case. You can read more about that at our website, eggscam.com. But But like I said, unfortunately, I don't think there is any shortage of ideas for ways to help animals because their abuse is so widespread.
At the beginning of the hour, we were speaking with Jonah Sachs, who was the creator for the of the Meetrix, and we were talking about, you know, how do you get the word out, and they're doing it through these animations that they do, flash animations, to try to raise awareness about factory farming. What types of strategies does Compassion Over Killing do once you've done an investigation, you've done an incredible amount of research, you've looked at all these industry publications, and then you're in a position where you're trying to get the word out there? How do you do it, and what kind of response have you gotten?
Well, Compassion Over Killing employs a variety of outreach tools. Not only do we engage in national advertising campaigns in teen women's magazines, in college newspapers, on TV, and in other venues, we also engage in an immense amount of in-the-streets outreach, both in Washington, D.C., and in other parts of the country as well, where we distribute every single year hundreds of thousands of pieces of literature promoting vegetarian eating. As well, we tour the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., two times a week with a mobile theater showing our investigative footage so that people on the street can witness for themselves what type of misery we force on other animals. And the reactions are always very powerful and very moving. Many people simply have no idea how bad conditions really are for animals on factory farms, and there's a good amount of them who, after being exposed to those conditions, talking with a friendly volunteer, getting free vegetarian recipes, and maybe our free vegetarian starter guide, which listeners can order from tryveg.com, a lot of them are changing their diets, and we receive letters, emails, and phone calls almost on a daily basis from people who have changed their lives, whether reduced their animal consumption, gone vegetarian, gone vegan. There's just a great number of people who are reaching, and we're not alone in this struggle. There are plenty of other animal advocacy organizations that are also doing fantastic work in utilizing the mainstream media, utilizing paid advertising, and in the streets outreach to expose people to the conditions that animals are suffering, because what we believe is that most people will be horrified when they find out what happens on factory farms. The factory farmer's worst nightmare are activists with video cameras who can document what conditions are really like. And, to use an example just of the power of imagery, just think about all the widespread reporting that we see all over the globe right now about the alleged abuse of Iraqi detainees by American soldiers. Those allegations had been occurring for months, but it wasn't until 60 Minutes 2 got its hands on actual photographs proving that the abuse existed that the world began to go into an outrage, as we're seeing now. And so hopefully we can create a condition where lots of people will be exposed to these images and will see for themselves and decide that they don't want to support that type of abuse.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's so impressive about Compassion Over Killing is, I think, because of the investigations that COK has done, is that you really get a sense that it's not just the bad cases out there that you're looking at, that this is widespread, it's standard industry practice, and these are conditions that, really infuse the landscape, and that they're not sort of the worst of the worst. You know, you go into a factory farm facility, you see these conditions over and over again.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We do not look for the worst of the worst. What we do is simply document the standard conditions on these farms. And cruelty is endemic to factory farming. That's really just the way it is. The abuse that we uncover and that you can watch on our videos, like 45 days, is absolutely standard practice. No matter what part of the country we go to, no matter what company owns the farm, we're finding really the same conditions, the same abuse, and the same disregard for very basic animal welfare.
Paul, we're at the end of the hour, but thanks so much for being on. If people want more information, they can check out your website at www.cok.net. And maybe for people who don't have ready access to the Internet, could you give us the number as well?
Yeah, sure. Anyone can call Compassion Over Killing at 301-891-2255. 2458. And if you're interested in getting our free vegetarian starter guide with recipes, ideas on making the transition, and a whole lot of other information, they can call 1-866-MEAT-FREE or just visit tryveg.com.
Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Lauren.